I'm Christopher Lydon with the Pulitzer and Bancroft Prize historian Gordon Wood, running the idealism and the realism of President Obama's world nation in 2010 past the founder's test, past George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, that is. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is about the Empire of Liberty. In one of Jefferson's phrases, Empire of Liberty is the title of Gordon Wood's magisterial new history of the early American Republic, 1789 to 1815, boom and transformation time on our shores. It was the rise and fall of Napoleon in the wider world. Empire of Liberty is also a neat capsule of the contradiction between a republic of free and equal, mostly rural yeomen, and a hegemonic global idea, at least, which might have partnered with the French Revolution to end monarchy and free the world. Gordon Wood, if there is a connection to be made across more than two centuries to President Obama's Nobel Peace Prize speech, you're the man to make it. Where do we start?
Well, I think Obama had a little bit of Hamilton and a little bit of Jefferson in that speech. He's a peacenik, but he's also a realist in that speech. That is, he says there's evil in the world, and war comes out of that evil. Jefferson would not have believed that. Jefferson was devoted to the idea that we could eliminate war. We could eliminate the use of military force. And Hamilton, on the other hand, is the realist. He says, no, war is not caused by monarchies. War is caused by human nature. They're evil people. So there was a little bit of each, I think, both a little Hamilton and a little Jefferson, a little realism, a little idealism in that Nobel Prize speech.
Is this a zero sum? Is it an old contradiction? Is it possible? Is it plausible? Is it progress? Is it peace? I mean, where does it come out?
Well, obviously, our American foreign policy has had both at the same time and sometimes alternating. And it's not a zero-sum game. You don't necessarily become less realistic by becoming more idealistic. But nonetheless, this is a dual strain that I think has run through our history from the very beginning. And Hamilton stood for the what we might call the realistic, the hard-nosed view, and Jefferson represented the idealistic view. Jefferson's view was really quite radical. He and other radicals like Thomas Paine had a vision of a world without war. If you could eliminate monarchy, monarchs they assumed were the cause of war. Their dynastic ambitions, their search for more and more territory led to the building up of military forces, the extracting of men and money from their societies in order to enhance their own dynasties. And if you could get rid of monarchs, and that had been the experience they thought, radicals thought, from the past three centuries, going back to the 1600s. If you could get rid of monarchs, you could establish what they called republics, but we would call democracies. And democracies do not go to war with one another. And therefore, you would have a universal peace. This was a vision of Kant, Immanuel Kant, as well as people, ordinary politicians or politicians like Thomas Jefferson. This is a radical vision coming out of the Enlightenment, that the world could be free of war. And it's been a vision, I think, for many of us, many people from ever since.
In what way is it or isn't it Barack Obama's sort of guiding intuition, do you think? To me, that's the question now. Is he a Kissingerian realist with a kind of ample room for necessary wars, unavoidable wars, just wars, good wars? Or is the mission to keep the world on that dream of peace?
Well, I think he represents the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party looks back to Jefferson. And it has been, especially over the last half century since Vietnam, the Peace Party. That is the party that would prefer to not engage use military force in any engagement. And Obama's got that as his base, and he obviously has to is trying to, and he himself may believe that as well. But he also, as he said in his speech, he's president of the United States, responsible for our national security, and he's aware of the threats from the Islamic radicals and fundamentalists. And so he's got to balance these two forces. I think conditions are curbing his base feelings, you might say, or certainly the Democratic Party's feelings about engaging in war. That's a strong feeling, and I think goes back to Jefferson. Now, modern-day Democrats don't believe in minimal government the way Jefferson did, but Jefferson's belief in minimal government came out of his fear of monarchical-type power. He thought that liberty was threatened by monarchs. We would call them, since we can't use monarchs today because half of NATO are monarchies, we have to talk about authoritarian governments. And we know, and generally I think most Americans feel that authoritarian governments are dangerous to liberty and they're a threat to the world. To world peace. So if you could get rid of authoritarian governments, said Jefferson, get rid of monarchs, and you would they had been the source of evil in the society. They had, domestically.
Commerce and free trade would be the healers of society.
Right. Well, not only domestically but internationally. Yes. But this has both. If you get rid of monarchs, you're getting rid of the source of distinctions in society. They thought all of the evils of society, even those who were wealthy and those who were poor, were caused by monarchs. Kings gave people honors, gave them titles. They created monopolies. If you could get rid of that kind of power, executive authority, you could have the natural sociability. The natural affection that people had for one another would free flow. Jefferson starts from a magnanimous view of human nature, as does Thomas Paine. These are the liberals of the 18th century. And they believe that people are naturally good, but they can't allow they're prohibited or inhibited from expressing their love, if you will, or affection for other people by the intervening forces of government, particularly monarchical government. So you get the government out of the way, people will naturally relate to one another through this social sense, this moral sense, and you'll have a natural harmony in the society. Now, it's a view that we no longer hold from the late 19th century on, but at the end of the 18th century, that was the liberal position. And so government is to be minimized. Get government out of the way of the natural flow. Can't we all get along? That, I think, was Jefferson's view. It is still, I think, very much the view of the Democratic Party, of people on the left in America and elsewhere in the world, that there's this natural feeling. You have a much rosier view of human nature than someone like Hamilton. Hamilton felt that people were naturally selfish. They're out for their own, and you needed to have strong government to protect people from one another. And he felt the same. You apply these principles to the world, as Jefferson and Hamilton did. Jefferson felt, let's get monarchs out of the picture and let because they cause war. Then we'll have commerce be the tie. Instead of having the natural sociability of people within a society, internationally the tie that held nations together was trade, was commerce.
Although, as you quote him, he was worried about the United States becoming a little Amsterdam. He thought too much commerce was a bad thing too for gentlemen on their land. But I want to come back to not only the book in general. And it's just what a wonderful experience it is reading it. I mean, you know these guys on a first-name basis and one feels them. But at the end, I must say, one of the things that strikes me is that we're still stuck in these Jeffersonian paradoxes. I mean, the libertarian slave owner is one big contradiction for starters. But then in world affairs, he is the champion of a kind of peaceful – open trading world. At the same time, in alliance with the French Revolution, a kind of zealotry in the world to spread liberty. Sounds like, you know, a better version of George W. Bush, kind of, we are the guarantors of liberty and we'll go anywhere to guarantee
it. That feeling came out of the Revolution, that we Americans were in the vanguard of history, leading the world towards a new libertarian, democratic future.
Right.
And Jefferson believes that. If you can get rid of the monarchs, and of course the French Revolution did get rid of a monarch, he celebrated that. He thought this was the beginning of a world revolution that was going to topple monarchs everywhere. And of course we supported every single Republican effort against monarchy throughout the 19th century. The Latin American states breaking away from Spain, the Greek Revolution, the Ottoman breaking from the Ottomans, in the revolutions of 1848, we were always the first state in the world to extend diplomatic recognition to these new Republican regimes. Many of them, of course, were abortive. I mean, the 1848 revolutions didn't work out. And we were criticized. I mean, there's some marvelous – it's not in this book because it deals with the 1848 revolutions. But when the Austrian-Hungarian minister objects to Daniel Webster, who's Secretary of State, says, you're fomenting revolution everywhere. And Webster doesn't duck that. We didn't send troops, of course, but we sent support, individuals, and gave verbal support. And Webster doesn't duck the there's no careful diplomacy. He says, yes, we are responsible. We take full responsibility. We, the United States, take full responsibility for all these revolutions. And then his message says, besides, he says, compared to the great United States, the Austrian-Hungarian Empire is but a patch on the Earth's surface. I mean, these were not normal diplomatic messages. This is Secretary of State talking to the Austrian-Hungarian minister in Washington. We were really full of ourselves, that we were leading the world towards democracy. And I think that's what Jefferson's talking about. The stakes were high for him, because if the French failed, the French Revolution fails, it looked as if maybe our own revolution would be endangered. So it was the moment at – by 1815, the French Revolution had failed. The Bourbons are back on the throne. The whole of Europe is back monarchy. The United States felt, I suppose, like the Soviet Union right after 1920s, socialism in one country, only we were republicanism or democracy in one country. There was a sense that we were isolated, and that is repeated in Lincoln's administration, with the last best hope. That sense that we were standing for something that was special runs right through our history. And so you can, Bush, when he went into Iraq to bring democracy to the Middle East, was appealing to that tradition. But the use of troops, that's fairly new, although we sent troops into the Soviet Union right after the Russian Revolution.
But reading your book and then the Nobel Prize speech, I just wonder, Gordon Wood, if President Obama isn't still, in a fashion, hung up on those contradictory impulses to be the hegemonic nation, which nowadays uses drones to, indicate its favor or its pleasure in places as far away as Afghanistan. Right. I mean, that would drive, I think, any of the founders, to distraction. The hegemonic power on one side and the exemplary power, the power of an idea, the dream of his father and all the rest of it. I wonder if those are resolvable differences.
Well, maybe not, because certainly Hamilton and Jefferson did not were not resolved. They had irresolvable differences. That is, Hamilton's view of what the United States should become was a fiscal military state like those of Europe. He wanted to be like France, like England, going to build up the military, going to have a standing army, going to have a bureaucracy, all of the attributes of a modern state he wanted the United States to become. And he thought it would take 4 or 5 decades, and then we'd be able to take on any of the European states on their own terms. Jefferson wanted no part of that. He wanted to go down a completely different path. He did not want to build up the United States in that way. He wanted to avoid having a standing army or a bureaucracy. And he did not want to use military force. That's why the embargo was so important to him. The use – that is, using his commercial – the commercial power of the United States by withholding it, he thought he could bring Britain and France to their knees. Now, it may have seemed utopian, and it was. I mean, he persisted for 18 months or so at terrible cost to his notion of executive authority. He was violating the Fourth Amendment on the Canadian border. He had martial law declared trying to enforce this embargo because he thought it was important. He thought the stakes were very high for him. He thought if he could make what he called this liberal experiment as an alternative to war, which we still believe in, economic sanctions, that you wouldn't have to have the awful power of military force where people are being killed. And to anything is better than war. And there is a strong feeling in the world, I think, about that. We still cling to the notion of economic sanctions.
Gordon Wood, could you bring those two gents, Jefferson and Hamilton, into the Oval Office with Barack Obama at this very, very interesting moment in which he has committed 35,000 more troops to Afghanistan? He's also set a timetable for getting out, but he's also told the world why the Nobel Peace Prize was not quite deserved, but was not mistaken either. We have that role. Can you imagine him turning to Hamilton and Jefferson and saying, you know, review this with me, gentlemen, if you will?
Yeah, I think they would have. Both would see something in his in his approach, but I suppose that Hamilton would not be entirely happy with his approach. He would think it was too Jeffersonian, and
in
not
what sense?
Well, in the sense that he's already
overextended.
Already intending to pull out, and he's really making that promise to cover his base, his Democratic base, and that his intentions in Afghanistan are essentially to get out in the best way possible without creating too many political problems for himself. I think Hamilton would take that rather cynical view of what Obama's doing.
And Jefferson?
Jefferson, I think, would believe that we should avoid war at all costs. And I think he would be in favor of getting out if we can talk about these historical characters having present-day relevance, which Americans like to do, which is strange itself. People ask me, you know, what would George Washington think of the invasion of Iraq? I think that that Jefferson would be on the side of getting out of the Middle East as quickly as possible.
Your book reminds me of, or just underlines for me, what seems to me the main, if largely unspoken, tension in our policy and politics today, which is the difference between the Republic that the founders put together in Philadelphia, and of which Franklin famously said, a republic if you can keep it, and the notion of a world ambitious empire, which we have sort of backed into. The Brits used to say, in a moment of inadvertence, but we've done it in a what seems irreversible way now. How do you see that tension, rooted in the founders, between the idea of a globally significant empire of ideas, of liberty, and maybe more, and the Republic of Yeoman Farmers?
Well, I think obviously Hamilton would be most pleased with the modern America, a huge bureaucracy. He would love the Pentagon, the CIA, all of the, you know, a million plus men and women under arms. This is all what he dreamed of, that we would be a great power. Jefferson would be appalled by the extent of presidential power, for example, and general federal governmental power would I think appall him. But I think he would also believe that we have tried to maintain our sense of ourselves as being the spokesman for democracy in the world, and that's been an important part of our history. And I think that the critics of Bush were appalled, not so much the use of troops, but it was the torture, it was the brutality, the un-American aspects of the war on terror that I think bothered a lot of people. And Jefferson would have been on that side, so he would feel, I think, that our idealism comes out of the Jeffersonian tradition. Mm-hmm. And we're full of paradoxes. I mean, Jefferson himself is the greatest paradox in American history, the greatest irony in American history, that our supreme spokesman for democracy should be a slaveholding aristocrat. Yes. Has to be ironic. And he is, I think, and legitimately so, a spokesman for democracy, because he did believe at heart that every person was the same. Now, not just that people are created equal. Everybody can believe that, and everybody did in the 18th century. But they create an unequal world. But Jefferson believed, despite the inequalities that you could see everywhere, you know, some people smarter, some people taller, some people run faster, inequalities everywhere in our society, Jefferson believed that beneath the surface, at bottom, we were all the same. We had the same moral sense, the same social sense, and he included slaves in this. And that makes him a spokesman for democracy. Washington and Hamilton did not accept that notion. And so in that sense, Jefferson – because I think to believe in democracy, you have to believe that at some level, everyone is the same. You can't just say they were the same at birth. They have to be at some basic level the same to sustain a democracy. And Jefferson believed that. And for that reason, despite being a slaveholder, despite being an aristocrat by our standards, he is, I think, a legitimate spokesman for democracy.
There's another connection here that I'd love to make between Jefferson and Obama on a word that you don't use, but the idea of a transnation. Jefferson's America is a kind of universal enlightenment, cosmopolitan nation of all nations. It coincides with an argument we've heard lately that before the United States was a nation, it was a transnation, and under the presidency of Barack Obama, with African forebears and Hawaiian birth, is himself an embodiment, even in his mind, of a notion of a transnational leadership. We are a kind of unique dream space on the planet, and we come by our leadership that way. It doesn't mean hegemony either, because Obama comes out of a kind of anti-imperial, anti-colonial tradition, right, on his father's side too. But I wondered, is there a connection there in the dreams of America to be made between Jefferson and Obama?
Well, yes, because we're not a nation in the usual sense of the term. There's no ethnic base. We got the whole world in the United States, and therefore we can't think of ourselves in any kind of ethnic way or tribal way, which is a great advantage for a nation of immigrants. We can absorb immigrants much more easily than the European nations. Now we think we have some problems with immigration, but they pale into insignificance compared to the problems that the European states are facing and will face over the next century, because these French, for example, they can't really believe those Arabs who have been living there for three generations in France are really French. They don't look French. They aren't French. And they're having real problems accepting that these alien forces that have come in. We can do that because to be an American is not to be somebody. It's to believe in something. And what you believe in are the things that came out of the Revolution: equality, liberty, constitutionalism, and the institutions that the revolutionaries created. That's why we go back to these founders in a peculiar way. I mean, the English don't go back to the William Pitt to find out what they're doing, but we go back to Thomas Jefferson or Alexander Hamilton or George Washington to take a kind of – to give us guides on how are we handling ourselves today? And that's why people say, well, would Jefferson approve of affirmative action? I mean, that's a kind of crazy statement when you think about it. But people want to know what these founders would think. And I think that's because they are our nation. They created the institutions and the values, all of them really, the highest values by which we live: equality, liberty, constitutionalism, and the institutions. So as long as this republic endures, we will go back to them to refresh and reaffirm ourselves as a nation. So our nationhood is really wrapped up in that idea. This is not an original idea with me. Many people have said that. America's an idea. It's not a usual nation. Jefferson, in fact, had a very peculiar notion of a nation. He didn't even think it had boundaries. It just was what people thought. If they think they're Americans and they cross into another territory, and people said, well, they might set up a separate state on the other side of the Mississippi. He said, oh, who cares, as long as they think American. I mean, that is an extraordinary notion, that to be an American is to have certain ideas about things. And whether you lived in a certain territory was irrelevant. And you have, of course, these Americans crossing into Mexican territory, Texas, which became Texas, but they didn't know they're going to create Texas. They're just moving out there because the Mexican government gave them a good deal on land. It's an extraordinary time when people really had very little connection to this thing called the United States at the outset. They moved, 50,000. This is after the Revolution. They moved into Canada just simply because the British government in Canada had woken up to reality and offered them a good deal for land, and they just moved up there without thinking, well, we're leaving our country, because the country really didn't mean much to them yet.
So what is stable and what is unstable, Gordon Wood, in Barack Obama's little bit of everything here in Afghanistan?
Well, I don't know. I think no one knows that. I think I mean, my own opinion is that we don't have the will to stay, and therefore probably that is the idea of staying 10 years in a counterinsurgency fight is just not it's just not in the cards for Americans. So we probably ought to get out as fast as we can and as decently as we can without creating too many problems. But that's probably what's going to happen.
That's my sense even of why he's sending the 35,000 escorts.
Right. That's cover politically for him for the pullout, if that's one way of putting it. He's starting the pullout so soon, although there's a lot of confusion about it because the Secretary of Defense keeps saying, well, we're not necessarily going to pull out in July of 2011. So it's getting a little blurred, but I think the American people are simply don't have the will to stay there for 10 years. Any more than the British had the will to continue the fight in the American Revolution. They weren't defeated. Mm. They lost Yorktown. They had another army in New York. They're still the greatest power in the world. The will to continue had eroded in back in London, and that's why the Americans won, not because we beat them any more than in Vietnam. You know, we were still the most powerful nation in the world, but we lost that war because the will to continue had gone, and that was true of Britain in 1783 as well.
Gordon Wood, it is a peculiar, special pleasure to gab with you, to bring the past to the present. I mean, no wonder Matt Damon quoted you in Good Will Hunting when he really had to nail an argument for a girl's heart. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Gordon Wood, who is the Alva Way Professor Emeritus of History at Brown. He's the author of The Radicalism of the American Revolution and The Purpose of the Past, among other classics. Hannah Olson and Ben Mandelkern are our associate producers and full-time readers at Open Source. Leave your own reading of history and politics and Gordon Wood with a comment at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.